Everything announced at this week's Google event. Is bullying worse on Instagram? And what about that Bloomberg chip story? Is it true or not? We don't find out today on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 53, recorded Thursday, October 11th, 2018. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where every week we talk to the people breaking the news and about some people who are making the tech news. I am Megan Maroney. Jason Howell is out this week, but weirdly, there is still tech news to talk about. Google announced new products this week, including new phones, tablets, and a brand new home hub. Joining us to discuss everything that Google has to offer is Sherilyn Lowe, reviews editor at Engadget. Welcome to the show, Sherilyn.
Hello.
So let's start with the Pixel 3. You had a hands-on, a quick hands-on. What are your first thoughts?
This thing feels amazing. That was my first thought. I've been using a Pixel 2 for a long time with a case, so I haven't really touched the phone itself for a long time. But the new Pixel 3 has a glass covering. It has rounded edges, something that Google said was like 3D glass. It's not only Google that's calling it that. But anyway, it's so sort of slightly curving glass that makes everything just feel very refined and smooth, almost like an iPhone 8, but rounder, curvier, nicer to hold. That's the first thing I noticed. But the screen also, when you look at it, is just beautiful. I don't know if we, really spent enough time to tell you more deeply about that, but that is one thing I noticed. It's a huge upgrade for my Pixel 2.
I think the last time we talked, you were in Barcelona for the launch of the newest Samsung phone, the Galaxy Note something or other. You were looking, I'm sure you know. You were talking about the camera, you went all over town, and it was a great camera. So I know you only took a few pictures, and some of the pictures were a little blurry, which you blamed yourself for. How did the camera compare to that?
Yeah, so comparing to the S9, S9 Plus, I don't know if, it's not an Apple's comparison, I don't think, because there's dual cameras on, Samsung's phones, including the Note 9, which was more recently announced, and the Pixel 3 and 3 XL only have a single camera. But it's, the Pixel 2 also having a single camera was one of the favorites of the entire tech industry last year. In my testing so far, the biggest difference I'm seeing really is that if you're looking at the pictures on the Pixel 2 versus on the Pixel 3, the Pixel 3's screen just makes your photos look so much better that it's easy to be tricked into thinking that the camera is actually that much better. Mm-hmm. I feel like you'd have to put them on the same device and compare the pictures. And I don't know that there's that much difference. Some of the features seem fun, but they're not necessarily useful, I don't think. Like photo booth is, a mode that lets you take hands-free pictures because the phone is just going to snap away when you're smiling. But there is a new second lens or camera up front that lets you squeeze in more friends in your selfies or more of your background. I personally like that a lot because it allows for, selfies that can show you what I'm wearing, aka crop tops, instead of just, from the neckline up, which is great. I can't really say all that much just yet about the new cameras just because, we haven't really spent that much time with it. And the selfies that I shared on Twitter, were indeed direct from the Pixel 3, but they definitely were blurry. And again, like I said on Twitter, definitely like human error, I feel like. I'd say stay tuned for deeper impressions. But so far, intriguing improvements, but doesn't seem to be groundbreaking.
So I know you review a ton of phones. So what is the phone that you most often go to, like your daily driver, as they call it?
I mean, currently my daily driver is still the Pixel 2. I can't wait so I can get the Pixel 3 as my daily driver. I've been playing with it and, yeah, I really just can't wait till review season is over and I can make that my primary phone. The Note 9 is another go-to. Huawei's P20 Pro has been another good one, just if we're talking just cameras themselves. You know, the Note 9 has good clarity and colors, but, you know, with Samsung software, it sometimes introduces artifacts, like its noise reduction is a little aggressive. And then with the P20 Pro, its artificial intelligent photographer software can also be a little aggressive, right? It's overly enthusiastic in terms of saturating your colors or upping the contrast. So the pictures are great for Instagram, but not good for like an accurate depiction of what real life looks like.
Okay, so let's move on to the Pixel Slate. First of all, yeah. What is it?
Right. I mean, if you want to guess from the name, the Pixel Slate is a tablet that runs Chrome OS, but it also, you know, Google has engineered a keyboard that is meant to go with the Slate to turn it into a more laptop-like configuration. You'll have to pay an extra $200 for it, though, but it probably will be worth it if, you know, you're looking for a multitasking device that can, you know, serve you well both in tablet mode and desktop mode. The most intriguing thing about this thing for me is Chrome OS's potential to work in both orientations, like as a tablet and as a laptop. This is a 12.3-inch screen using a LCD display with low temperature polysilicon technology that is energy saving, which allowed Google actually to squeeze a lot more pixels into this device than, you know, its rivals in the space. So it is a 3,000 by 2,000 pixel resolution, higher than the iPad Pro, the Microsoft Surface Pro 6, and the Galaxy Tab S4. And so that makes for like really good videos, or if you want to do some photo editing on your tablet on the go, you can.
How does it compare in price, like to the iPad Pro or the Surface?
So controversial. Starting price, base configuration, it is cheaper by hundreds of dollars. But you're getting like an Intel Celeron, you're getting like 4 gigs of RAM. It's not the most powerful combination if you're thinking your base starting price. You can go up to Intel Core i5, even Core i7, if you somehow want a Chrome OS device with Core i7, which is kind of overkill. And 16 gigs of RAM. You can go up really high. But most people will probably shoot for somewhere in the middle, like with a Core M3, and that will cost you roughly the same as the iPad Pro and the Surface Pro 6. So it's nice to have that cheaper option to start off with. I haven't played with a low power version to see if that'll hold up, but I know that Chrome OS in general is a lightweight operating system that doesn't really require all that much resources. But again, it depends on what you're getting this device for. If you want to get serious work done, you're going to have to like spring for a bit more in terms of the processor and the RAM.
Okay, so the only thing that tempted me as an iPhone and a MacBook user was the Home Hub. Tell us what your thoughts on that.
This thing is so cute. It's small. It's really small. It's like I held it in my hand. It felt like I was holding a flower pot or something. It's a 7-inch, I believe, screen on a speaker base. And it's a smart display, which means that it will show you things like, you know, by default, say the weather and your upcoming day, and what events are there in your calendar. It will also show you YouTube videos, so you can watch a recipe in the kitchen if you need. And then when it's not doing anything that you want it to do, or if it's just lying around your home, it can be a digital photo frame. So it will cycle through pictures in your Google Photos account, or, you know, just random Google Photos that you like and are, you know, higher quality than what you might shoot yourself. I personally didn't hear the sound when we were at the event. A, it was really noisy, and B, you see Nate Ingram from Engadget over there. He's the one that was in charge of getting our hands on with this device. But, you know, from the looks of it, this thing, it's just so cute. And there's 4 colors that are, you know, I told Google that my best friend's home is like a gray and pink color scheme. So I'm going to get her the pink version of the Home Hub because it's going to fit in really nicely. And it's like $150 if you have, you know, the money to spare. This is a nice gift for both yourself and like a very good friend.
Yeah, the price is really what tempted me. And then, you know, I tried to play. I was reminded of the ability on my Echo Show that I have at home that it can play pictures. But then I asked it to play pictures, and it just didn't compare because, first of all, it's only the pictures that I have gone to the effort of uploading to my Amazon Prime account. And then it's just all the garbage. But Google, I presume, I mean, my Google Photos account, I presume it would show only the best photos and only the things that I wanted it to see.
Yeah. Yeah, you can select like people that you like. So pick the faces that you want to include in, I think what they're calling live albums. I'm not sure about the name 100%. But yeah, so they'll curate albums for you based on the faces that you like. And the software is smart enough to like take, like leave out pictures that are either blurry or not pretty, I guess, and that are repetitive. So if you've taken, if you're like me, you take maybe like a ton of selfies a day, it'll like just pick out the ones that are not like, you know, there's not a lot of change in between them. It'll just pick out the best to be in that album that you rotate through on your home hub.
My problem is screenshots. Like Amazon is not smart enough to take out the screenshots. And I assume Google really is, because it's Google's always reminding me like to get rid of all the screenshots that I upload to Google Photos.
Right. I mean, assuming there aren't faces in your screenshots, it should be smart enough to do that. And it, I mean, Google has been very good at detecting screenshots in my phone as well. So I am assuming that it should be better at that. But again, haven't played with it. Can't tell you for real if it will work.
And so what do you think of the choice of not to include a camera in the device?
It's an interesting, I think a lot of people are happy that Google didn't include a camera in the device. And I think in terms of keeping costs down and the size that it is, you know, it's a good decision. I personally prefer to have the option given to me and then have it come with like a physical switch or a physical cover so that people can feel safe by like sliding a shutter over a camera. But, you know, overall as a business decision, I get it. You know, it's $150 is better than stuffing a camera into a device that doesn't really need it.
Right. And I think they're pushing for like, you can keep this in the bedroom and it's like a bedside table TV or, you know, and then with a camera that can, you know, cause all kinds of anxiety for certain people to have a camera right next
right.
to
it. And you don't want to put scotch tape over such a pretty little thing, do you? So.
No, you do not. And have you tried, did you try the Lenovo Google Home thing? I don't remember what they call smart display, the Lenovo smart display.
There you go.
Did you have a chance to try that?
I did take a look at it at CES. We do also have our review units of that. I didn't review it. And I, again, haven't played with the Echo Show either. Screens in my home very much, but there is a report came out yesterday, I think from Ars Technica, that Google is using a cast based OS for its home hub, whereas it's using an Android Things based system for the Lenovo smart display and the JBL Link View. And it may like it, functionally, I can't tell if there's a difference, but it might. And that would be the biggest differentiator, I think. Otherwise, it does seem that across the board, the interface is very similar because they're very assistant heavy. Mm-hmm. And assistant is similar across all of its visual interfaces. So I don't know that there will be an actual functional difference between the devices just yet.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan. I tried it for a couple weeks and it just, and maybe it was because even though I use Google Photos pretty regularly and I use Gmail and I use Google Calendar, I don't really use the Google Home app. Like my smart home stuff is connected either through Amazon or through Apple's HomeKit. So maybe that was why it didn't really work. But there were a lot of things that were promised, like that you'd be able to watch HBO, and then that wasn't there yet either. So I wasn't impressed. And part of me wonders if Google really knew that they were going to be coming out with this other device. And so sort of, you know, I don't know, created this AP. Is it an APL that allows third parties to create API or APL to create these devices?
Oh, I think they work closely together with their like third-party OEMs. And I think you're talking about the Lenovo smart display, right? Mm-hmm. Like with companies making these. So yeah, it's not 100% clear yet. If it's Android Things, then it is that like they have this program, they offer it to companies. Companies who have interest can work with them on making it. The features that you talked about, like playing HBO videos on these smart displays, it's not clear also to me whether HBO has to work with Google, have to make an app for it, use the API to create something. It's again, I am not like up to speed on the smart display side of things. However, the home app, I just played with a redesign the other day. It's so much better than the older version. It makes controlling my smart home devices much easier. It's putting all the important switches and controls on the front page where I need it. And it just looks much nicer too. So like you, I have an Amazon Echo that I use to control everything else, but the new Home app has got me thinking if I need to just let Google take over.
Let Google take over. Just let them have everything.
Just have me, have all of me. Yeah.
Sherilyn, thank you so much for joining us. Sherilyn Lowe is a reviews editor at Engadget, and she is Sherilyn Lowe on Twitter. So check out all of her reviews of the Pixel from her hands-on and just basically her coverage of the entire event. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care.
Bye.
So over the summer, I was chatting with a group of eighth graders who were shocked that one of the kids did not have an Instagram account. When asked why she didn't have one, the girl answered, "Insta-hurt feelings. That's what my mom calls it." So how much bullying is really going on with teens on Instagram? And is it any different than what the rest of us all experienced as teens? To help answer this question, I'm joined by Atlantic staff writer and teen tech expert Taylor Lorenz.
Hi.
Hi, welcome back to the show. So in your piece, you wrote that kids are always being bullied, have always been bullied, but now Instagram provides a unique set of tools to do that bullying. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of tools make it easy for bullies,
yeah.
I guess?
So basically, yeah, bullies. Instagram is just a really massive platform, and it's very easy for things on there to kind of like get traction and go viral, almost the same way as things do on Twitter. I mean, there's no internal sort of resharing mechanism like Twitter, you know, has a retweet, but people screenshot, people can also tag. And it's just, the thing is it's sort of like this digital manifestation of teens' social lives. I mean, it really is where most social interaction happens for teens when they're not in school or hanging out IRL. And so, it sort of just becomes this place where obviously bullying dynamics can play out. It also, I guess, like the fact that you can set up anonymous accounts so easily makes it really easy to bully people. You can just set up new accounts all the time if somebody blocks you.
It's odd that Facebook really went the way of like, you know, you have to be a real person, and it was harder, especially in the beginning, it was harder to create a fake account, but it's so easy on Instagram.
It's so easy on most social networks, and I think that that's a good thing in a lot of ways. I mean, I think having your one account tied to this one offline identity is a very sort of like antiquated idea of of identity and like how people's identities should be manifested online. But I do think that it does cause problems, especially for bullying. And Instagram has put in some protections, just not quite as many. It's some of this bullying too is so subtle. It's not anything that an Instagram moderator could even, you know, necessarily comprehend. So it's hard.
Well, I know a lot of parents who just say, no Snapchat. My kids can't use Snapchat, but then they let them use Instagram pretty easily. I mean, is there really any difference when it comes to bullying or it's not?
No, I mean, Instagram's worse. It's weird that you would let your children use Instagram over Snapchat when Instagram is this wide open social network where you can like basically be harassed 24/7 and like encounter all these different new people. Whereas Snapchat's a closed network. It's like inherently more safe. But, you know, parents don't know. And I would say any parent that's like, oh, yeah, I don't let my kids do this. Like so many kids just do it anyway. And, you know, just don't tell their parents about it. So I think I'm not a parent, but I can't totally empathize. I know it's hard, but I feel like as the teens that I talked to, the ones who said they had spoken to their parents were ones that had really kind of open and honest relationships with their parents. And their parents had made it clear, like, look, you know, I don't care if you got yourself into a little bit of trouble. I just want you to talk to me about it if things go bad.
Yeah, that is easy to say. And
I know.
I know. It's something I say every day. And my kids are like, I know, you've told us that. But I guess the other thing about, I think maybe the parents that I'm talking to are a lot of them started using Instagram or let their kids start to use Instagram maybe 3 or 4 years ago before there was all the instant messaging. Or, you know, the instant messaging is so hard to find. I know a lot of parents who don't even know that that exists, that there's messaging on Instagram at all. Like they just think it's just like pictures.
Yeah, And a lot of, I mean, I would say most parents that I've talked to too are totally unaware how many accounts their kids have. Mm-hmm. Like their kids will be like, yeah, I just have my Instagram account. But meanwhile, they're running like, you know, some meme page and they have some other account for different types of stuff or like, you know, so I think Instagram does allow you to toggle between accounts really easily. It allows you to set up accounts really easily and you can run them anonymously or in groups, which a lot of teens do. And for a lot of teens, that's totally harmless. But, you know, there's always so much drama when you're kind of that age and it can manifest itself really easy digitally.
One thing about your piece that I found fascinating is some of these kids who are being bullied, who have accounts that are that someone has created specifically to bully them, they're actually filing cease and desist letters. Like, that's pretty mature for a teenager.
Well, I would say a lot of kids are like a billion times more savvy than you'd give them credit for. Mm-hmm. But yeah, one girl who had just multiple hate pages, which are these Instagram pages that are just sort of like dedicated to trashing one person, she got so fed up with it. And so she went online and Googled like legal, you know, cease and desist form and just like filled it out and then sent it to the girl, like, you know, via screenshot or something. And teens aren't that legally savvy. So I guess that was enough for the girl to be like, oh, you know, I'm not trying to get sued and back off. It was pretty, I mean, I think like anyone that's being harassed, you just want it to stop. And mm-hmm. So at some point you're going to try to do anything you can to make it stop.
And I think as adults, we often think like the bullying is like, you know, we're going through our kids' Instagram feed and we don't see anyone saying like you're ugly or you're fat or anything like, oh, well, they're not being bullied. But there are all kinds of ways. Like you said, there's the other accounts. There are, you know, comments posted on other people's accounts in the comment section. And then there's other things that are more nefarious, like blocking and unblocking. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, just having someone block you is kind of an aggressive act to begin with. That's hurtful. I mean, so much bullying does occur in the comments, but I mean, so much bullying is also concentrated in other accounts. Like there's a lot of sort of high school accounts too that are like high school gossip pages where everyone will just send in gossip about certain kids and it'll all be sort of like published anonymously on some page. Also, there's just, yeah, a million other features that you can use to harass someone. The thing is that, you know, especially when you're young, you're so conscious of like subtle social hierarchies and sort of like reading into every single interaction. Like my friend didn't like this photo, but she liked this photo, or like, you know, the tagging functionality, you can see like maybe a friend posted a picture of, you know, all five of you guys hanging out and tagged everyone but you. Like that could be really hurtful, you know? But it's subtle. It's not like somebody, you know, calling you out. It's more like excluding or just, you know, intentionally being hurtful in sort of these subtle ways that it's easy. It's not easy for any kind of third party to pick up on.
I have twin 13-year-old boys, and one of them was asking, like, why haven't you liked any of my Instagram pictures? Did you see them? And I was like, no, I haven't seen them. And I went on and my phone and realized, like, he had been blocked. And I think his twin brother went on my phone to block his brother from me. So it's like, that is the height of sibling rivalry. Like, that.
Yeah. Trying to get those likes. Yeah.
Exactly. So kids are tricky. So some schools are instituting rules around this. Like, you can't take pictures of anyone at school at all. Talk a little bit about what you heard from kids about that.
Yeah. So he's not quoted in the piece, but I talked to a high school principal about this kind of extensively too, just how hard it is. You know, for schools, they don't have the authority to really police people's online behavior. So they kind of do what they can. A lot of high schools have banned, you know, picture takings just because so many people were taking creep shots of other kids and posting them in mean ways. A lot of schools have, you know, have Instagram completely blocked. Like you can't access, you know, it on the web or whatever. It's such a losing game. It's really hard. I mean, also like the principal I spoke to had, you know, they had this assembly on bullying and kids were just like making mean memes of the principal the whole time in the assembly. It's like, it's really hard. And I think, I mean, but I still think like things like that assembly and these rules are necessary, even though kids are going to get around them and they're going to be mocked. You know, schools or administrators are going to be mocked for doing it. It still, I think, stems the problem or at least communicates that it's not okay and that this kind of behavior is not okay. which is important.
Yeah, I think sometimes when you get the like, oh, nothing's safe, like parents just give up. Like, you can't give up. You got to keep
gotta keep trying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you can say like, oh, well, I'll try to limit Instagram. But you said kids are even using SoundCloud to bully each other.
Oh, yeah. Well, kids use anything to bully each other. Like, kids use, and that's true for any kids of any generation. Yeah. Like, they'll just always use everything. So, there's a whole piece that could be written about all the other platforms kids use to harass each other. But, yeah, this one poor girl had been this, I don't know the exact high school drama that happened, but this other girl and guy wrote this entire, like, diss track against her, basically like saying all this bad stuff about her, and posted it to SoundCloud, which is this sort of, you know, file sharing site for music, and all these other kids immediately updated it, put it in their Instagram bio, and she was devastated. And there was there's no recourse. You can't tell SoundCloud to take it down. The kids themselves obviously aren't going to take it down, so it can be really hurtful.
So, you know, bullying is not okay. We all agree on that, hopefully. And all these tools, like, is nothing safe? Is everything safe? Like, what? I mean, to some extent, adolescents, this is what they're supposed to do, right? Like, it's some sort of, like, we're trying to figure out who we are, and we're not like this person and that person. So, when you talk to teenagers, what do they most want? Have you talked to them about what they most want from parents or adults, or even the technologies to help with
this? I mean, I think with solving bullying is really hard. There's so many safeguards that Instagram could put in place, but I think that as a platform, it doesn't seem like they really have taken harassment seriously. I mean, people get just as much harassment on Instagram as they do on Twitter, and Twitter has this bad rap and has had to have this whole public reckoning, and there's all this stuff happening on Instagram too. But I think, you know, when it comes to bullying, it is really subtle. The kids that I spoke to all just said that they wish that their parents were more open. I mean, it's so hard because I've been in that position too. You know, when you're a teenager, like, you're not really ever going to tell your parents everything. And it's embarrassing too. Like, a lot of the kids were like, I don't want to tell my mom. Like, I feel embarrassed about it. Kind of, they don't want to acknowledge it. Or they feel like their parents are going to make it worse, or like call that person's parents. But I will tell you, one girl that, you know, she did end up telling her mom, and the mom did call the other girl's mom, and it did stop. And it had been, you know, she tried to resolve it on her own for months. So I think she was mortified in the moment, but ultimately glad that her mom did that. Kids say like, oh, parents should just let us do whatever. Parents should just make it so we can trust them. But I think sometimes parents do have to step in and like mortify their kids a little bit to like resolve this.
Taylor, thank you so much for joining us again. Taylor Lorenz is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She is Taylor Lorenz on Twitter. I just love, I mean, you do write about other things besides teens and technologies.
Yeah.
And so I love your work there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Take care. Last week, Bloomberg Businessweek reported that Chinese spies infiltrated almost 30 U.S. companies, including Amazon and Apple, through the technology supply chain. Now, Amazon and Apple strongly denied the story, but one of the sources, Yossi Applebaum, CEO of Cepio Systems, says this is an industry-wide problem. Joining us to talk about the plausibility of this kind of hacking is ethical hacker Vinny Troy. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what can you tell us about how China might infect our hardware, like the Bloomberg story, at the supply chain level?
It's certainly an intriguing story. When you look at it from the perspective of, you have some of the largest companies in the world that are doing their manufacturing over in a country that we're known to be cyber adversaries with. I mean, it's certainly very plausible. And when you think about the amount of time and resources it would take for a nation state to either train people to hack our systems or even to do the hacking itself, I mean, it seems like a much shorter kill chain to just go right for the manufacturing and infect the chips at the supply chain level. That being said, I don't know how plausible it would be. I mean, I don't know what the security around, the manufacturing is. And, you know, I mean, it certainly sounds like a very cool spy-esque kind of story. But, again, it's hard to say how real it would be.
Now, does the NSA and the CIA, do they conduct kind of these kinds of operations? Are they trying to infiltrate the supply chain around the world?
Sure. So, there have been publicized stories of both the NSA and the CIA I believe maybe a couple years ago, there were a number of NSA tools that were leaked, one of which was a, I forget the name of it, but it was a hardware, it was a hard drive firmware. It was a piece of malware for hard drives that lived in the firmware. So whenever the hard drives would wipe, were to be wiped, the firmware would essentially reinstall itself, putting the malware back on the hard drive. And I mean, there were certainly a number of CIA tools that were released as well that were very hardware specific, that were literally embedded in the devices themselves. So I mean, this is definitely the type of stuff that's being developed, not only by our nation, but by other nations as well.
Okay, so the NSA says this didn't happen. Apple says it didn't happen. Amazon says it didn't happen. Do you think it happened?
I don't know. I mean, here's kind of how I look at it. If it did happen, and I'm not saying it did, but if it did, I can't imagine a company like Apple or Amazon suddenly saying, yep, all of our hardware has been infected, do a recall. I mean, it's just not plausible. That being said, I can't imagine that the security around, again, the supply chain of the manufacturing process isn't pretty locked down. So it would be really hard to say. I mean, something this sort of a widespread seems a little bit on the sci-fi side for me.
So this isn't normally, this isn't the kind of hacking that you usually look into. You usually look, last time we spoke to you, we were talking about data breaches. So you're usually like looking for our personal data that someone's just left out there. Is this, I mean, how would someone, I mean, you explained a little bit last time you were talking to us how you do that, but how would someone find out whether this was true? How would someone be able to find out if this kind of stuff was on the chips?
Well, and that's kind of the interesting thing, too. I mean, when I read the Bloomberg story initially, I mean, they showed a picture and the chip was so tiny that I don't know how anybody would have found it. I mean, it seems like maybe they were looking for something specific. There, yeah, exactly. So I don't know how you even begin to look for hardware or look at hardware for little chips that size and then begin to sort of reverse engineer it to see what's even on there. I mean, it just seems very... It seems like a long shot, to be honest with you.
So do you think these anonymous sources, Bloomberg's anonymous sources, do you think they are making it up? Or do you think they're just like it's just a big, you know, rumor, like an urban legend type of thing?
It could be. I mean, and who knows? I mean, maybe for all we know, I mean, maybe there are parts of the story that are legitimate and the anonymous sources are suddenly saying that, you know, maybe they found one or two instances, for example. Maybe, you know, from that, the story kind of spiraled out to it suddenly being that all these chips were, or all these, you know, devices were infected with these chips, where maybe it was, you know, sort of like a onesie, twosie kind of incident. And I'm not saying that's not significant in itself. I just, you know, unless there's more evidence around what actually happened, it'd really be hard to say.
It's interesting that Bloomberg is sort of still sticking to this. I mean, they released another updated story, like a telecom story. What do you make of that story?
Same thing. I mean, you know, I looked at it, but again, I mean, it's really hard to say without, you know, I mean, somebody's going to have to look into this, right? And so I would imagine there'd be some sort of investigation outside of just what Bloomberg did. I mean, I imagine our government would want to start looking into it, and there would have to be some sort of formalized report. It would probably hit Congress or, you know, the Senate at some point. I mean, there would have to be something more than just a Bloomberg story about it.
So updates have you found? Any have you found my social security number online lately?
I haven't been looking for social security numbers, but there was a pretty big breach that was announced a couple probably last week. A company called Apollo leaked quite a bit of information. Same similar story. They just kind of left it wide open. The really interesting thing with this was that not only did they leak their own information, but it turns out that they were scraping information from their customers via the Salesforce API. And so they were pulling down data that maybe they shouldn't have had. And it turns out they were leaking that as well. So some of the stuff that they had been grabbing were like the opportunity data. So like the sales, any won or lost sales for a company, they were literally just pulling it down from their customers. So you end up having quite a bit of data there when you can sort of look up the sales history for any, you know, for pretty large companies. So it was pretty significant from that perspective.
Well, Vinny, thank you so much for joining us. Vinny Troy is a security expert and founder of Night Lion Security. Thanks so much for talking to us again.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
You too.
And finally, it seems you can get anything on demand today, including grandkids. TechCrunch reports that a new startup called Papa will connect college students to senior citizens for companionship and assistance. Now, if you're a senior interested in spoiling someone rotten or just trying to correct the mistakes you might have made raising your own children, simply request a Papa Pal from the mobile app or the desktop site. The GOD, or Grandchildren on Demand service, recently graduated from the Y Combinator Seed Accelerator and raised $2.4 million. The biggest thing the startup founder, Andrew Parker, says he's trying to do with Papa is to cure loneliness. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can watch it while we're making it, and you can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. You can also come watch us, just email tickets@twit.tv. We would love it if you subscribe to our show on however you watch podcasts, twit.tv/TNW. Now, I got an email that someone who has updated in the new Apple TV hasn't been able to watch our podcast on their Apple TV podcast app. I watched it, so this might just be a one-off. But if you're having trouble watching on Apple TV, email me at megan@twit.tv, and I want to find out whether there's any problem. And find me on Twitter. I'm at Megan Maroney. And I want to thank Josh and John and Colleen and Burke and Lisa and Leo. And especially thanks to you. We'll see you next week on Tech News Weekly.